This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with journalist Kevin Gostola about whistleblower Julian Assange's show trial extradition hearing, which is receiving virtually no media coverage.
A show trial is a trial where the conclusion is foreordained. This is what it appears to be what we are facing in defending free journalism.
The COVID-19 pandemic is ravaging the nation's prison systems, which are overcrowded and unable to provide personal protective equipment and much-needed medical help.
A prison is probably the worst place a person could be to defend him or herself against COVID. Nevertheless, Governor Cuomo has done very little to let out people, particularly elderly people, who are about to die in many, many numbers.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The problem of the U.S. election between Biden and Trump from the standpoint of defending free national security journalism was that one of them would win. Whereas Trump was a caricature of the system, Biden is its embodiment. He has pledged, quote, nothing will fundamentally change. This is the fear of Julian Assange and his defenders. The Trump administration initiated an indictment against Julian Assange for 17 counts of espionage. Assange revealed U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan 10 years ago. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo called his organization, WikiLeaks, which published his whistleblowing articles, quote, a non-state hostile intelligence entity, end quote. Biden has called Assange, quote, a high-tech terrorist, end quote. Hillary Clinton said, quote, we should drone him, end quote. One of the legal advisors to Biden was a prosecutor in the Eastern District of Virginia and sent whistleblowers John Caracou and Jeffrey Sterling to federal prison. He wanted to indict Julian Assange, but left office to join a private law firm before he could get around to it. Julian Assange is now in solitary confinement in Britain's infamous and COVID-wrecked Belmarsh prison in London. He's in terrible physical and mental shape. The extradition request of the United States has been litigated. We await the judge's decision, which is expected on January 4. The defense has submitted their arguments in support of Julian, principally that this is a political prosecution, which is illegal under an American-British treaty. We speak today with journalist Kevin Gostola. He covered the recent extradition hearing and has been writing on whistleblowers for many years. He writes for Substack and does the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. He has closely followed the Julian Assange case.
Kevin Gostola, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Kevin, we'd like to get an update from you on Julian Assange's situation and his possible paths to freedom. As our listeners know, there's been a pretty extensive media blackout of the extradition hearing, but you covered it. What was the basis of the American government's request to have Julian extradited and brought to the USA for trial? And then, if you will, what did he do to embarrass the U.S. government?
I'd say that the Trump Justice Department made the decision to indict Julian Assange for the disclosures that were widely publicized and disclosed by Chelsea Manning to WikiLeaks. And these are the Iraq war logs, the Afghanistan war logs. This is the collateral murder video that had the helicopter attack in Baghdad that, you know, captured a lot of people's attention as it depicted a war crime that was unfolding, multiple war crimes. There's the massive cache of over a quarter of a million diplomatic cables that gave us incredible insight into the way the entire, I'd say, global U.S. empire functions. And we also had files on the Guantanamo prisoners. Hundreds of Guantanamo prisoners, their files were revealed in the sort of trumped up and fabricated evidence against them that was being used to keep them in indefinite detention. And so they say that these disclosures violate the Espionage Act. And also the way that they present it is to make us believe that there's some kind of a conspiracy that happened where Julian Assange essentially recruited Chelsea Manning to leak these documents on behalf of WikiLeaks. Mike Pompeo, as the CIA director, made a point of targeting WikiLeaks early in his administration of the agency and singled out WikiLeaks as a non-state hostile intelligence agency. So the U.S. government has truly taken a position that a media organization is not that and is in fact kind of intelligence style outfit, and have suggested that Chelsea Manning had no agency, didn't make this choice on her own, even though we know from her own statement during her court-martial that that's absolutely not true. And they tried to get her through a grand jury subpoena. They tried to force her to testify against Julian Assange, but she held to her principles and was very courageous and went to jail for about a year. And to great psychological trauma she experienced, but she never decided to provide any testimony for the government's case so that they could use it to extradite Julian Assange and maybe even use it during his trial. So what he did to embarrass the U.S. government is he exposed U.S. torture. He exposed the way in which the U.S. government was strong-arming, particularly European governments like Spain and Germany, to not investigate Bush administration officials who were implicated in torture. It exposed the drone program. And so all of these different things were documented clearly in these files, and it showed the extent to which the U.S. would suppress this information.
So what is Julian's defense, Kevin, to these charges that he was a spy and that he committed criminal acts? What does Julian say in his own defense?
Well, for one, they haven't really presented any evidence in this case that he is a spy. So I want to be very clear about that. Although the law, as it's drafted, would target someone for that. I mean, he's being prosecuted in the same way that Obama targeted whistleblowers during his administration in a way that was, unprecedented and more aggressive than any other prior presidential administration, something that Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg has focused on very closely, and a lot of other advocates, press freedom groups, paid a lot of attention to the Obama administration and how they went after whistleblowers. But, they didn't indict Julian Assange. They made a decision not to do that. And so, in this case, what the defense is really pinning their hopes on in trying to prevent this extradition is to say, well, it's politically motivated. Donald Trump's administration chose to indict Julian Assange after President Barack Obama's Justice Department made a completely opposite decision. And they'll say things like, Chelsea Manning was prosecuted. She was convicted. She was sentenced to a military prison. Why didn't they turn around right after that and indict Julian Assange if they believed he was implicated in crime? And they point out that it's got to be retaliation. They say because he exposed the United States and its involvement in war crimes or crimes against humanity or other misconduct, that in fact, that is why the Trump administration is trying to go after Julian Assange. And even going so far as to bring in a more salient and recent example of how the Trump administration has sanctioned officials who are on the International Criminal Court and are daring to investigate war crimes in Afghanistan that may have been committed by the CIA or U.S. military personnel or coalition forces. And so they say that's the other thing is to have a standard kind of an extradition defense that we've seen in these cases that's become routine, where you suggest that the person's mental health is such that if they're extradited to the United States and put in a prison, they'll be put in solitary confinement conditions in a supermax facility, and they'll be essentially subject to what under the UK law should be considered cruel and inhuman treatment and would amount to torture potentially. And so they're using these kinds of arguments to try and prevent Julian Assange's extradition.
Kevin, a show trial is defined as a trial whose outcome is guaranteed in advance. Do you think that this is the case with the trial of Julian Assange?
But the one thing I'll say to that question is that we know from some very good independent reporting by an organization in the UK called Declassified UK that her name is Vanessa Beretzer. She's the magistrate court judge that has been reviewing Julian Assange's case. We know that in her history, when she's reviewed extradition cases, 96 or 97% of the time, she's approved those extradition cases. And she's been a kind of rubber stamp, or has been viewed as a kind of rubber stamp when it comes to her work in the judiciary. So I think that to the extent that this case is political and the British government would like to see Assange handed over to the United States, and she's someone who's concerned with her own upward mobility and her career and maybe angling for a higher position on a higher court in the British judicial system, I think that it might be ordained already. It's definitely been my sense as I follow this trial that he probably will be extradited to the United States, or that she will authorize that extradition. But I will also say that the format of an extradition trial in the UK is such that the defense has to prove that there isn't a reason why he should be extradited. In other words, the burden is entirely on the defense. It's not the other way around as it would be in a trial, because if there's any reasonable suspicion that he committed a crime, then they're going to extradite him to the United States.
So what's at stake if he is extradited, sent to the United States, tried and convicted? What's at stake?
Well, what's at stake is global press freedom. I have articulated it in such a way we would see other country governments potentially feel that they could bring similar leaked prosecutions against international or global correspondents. They could go after smaller media organizations that don't have lawyers to represent them and protect them from kind of global cases of this magnitude. And for example, you could see perhaps the Russian government or the Chinese government or the Israeli government or the Turkish government or the Saudi Arabian government or the Brazilian government under Jair Bolsonaro. In fact, we've seen the case that was almost very nearly brought against Glenn Greenwald when he was doing reporting on Brazil for The Intercept, and that seemed to be very similar to the kind of case that they were claiming against Julian Assange, where there's, you know, somewhat of a nexus to this idea that Julian Assange was involved in hacking materials from government agencies or private organizations. So I think it would be a green light for countries around the world to try and assert authority over their own secret private documents, and if someone obtained them, it would give them a tool to target journalists.
Kevin, let's talk for a minute about the global reach of the United States. What did the American government succeed in doing in pressuring Sweden, Great Britain, Ecuador, and Australia?
What they were able to do by targeting Julian Assange and putting pressure on all these countries is to essentially force them into serving their own interests and also sending a message. I mean, they succeeded in sending a message to other journalists that this is what will happen to you if you go down the path that Julian Assange went down. If you go down the path of forming a leak organization that for the purpose of transparency and forcing transparency does not take up any kind of address. I mean, he deliberately tried to set it up in a way that it would not be beholden to any one country. But what we've seen now is that he essentially became trapped in the clutches of this cluster of nations that was able to engage in what UN Special Rapporteur Niels Meltzer has characterized as mobbing or character assassination, this public mobbing campaign. We've seen so many fabricated stories, so many smears woven and spread and disseminated about Julian Assange. We've seen the allegations, the sexual allegations against him, misused and abused by the prosecution authority in Sweden. Oh, and I've been very clear that it's possible that something went on and the women who accused him deserve justice, but you cannot see justice in a prosecution authority that opens the case, closes the case, opens the case, closes the case, opens the case, closes the case, and isn't following particular procedures in order to be fair to a defendant like Julian Assange. And in effect, they deprived any of these women a chance to hear their accusations heard in a public courtroom by a judge because they mishandled and were clearly, in my view, using this case for a political purpose to keep Julian Assange in limbo so that they could, you know, serve whatever agenda the United States was imposing upon them. And all of these countries very clearly have been told all along whether Julian Assange was going to be charged with a case, that there was some benefit to keeping him tied up in these cases. It was disruptive to the WikiLeaks organization, and we saw in the last 10 years the rapid decline of the organization and what it was able to do in order to have an impact, and how it's been discredited. You know, and at this point, especially with the investigation by Special Counsel Robert Mueller, everyone associates WikiLeaks with Russian intelligence, even though Julian Assange came out before he was arrested and expelled and insisted that his source was not Russian, was not a Russian state source. And he didn't have to reveal that information because, you know, as a journalist, you're allowed to keep your sources confidential. But the smears were just so intense that he had to say something to tell people that, you know, no, I can't tell you who my source is, but it's not what you think.
So what do you think the chances of the Biden administration, this new administration, reversing Trump's decision, dropping the charges against Julian? What kind of pressure will it take to force them to do it?
Well, they're going to need it to be a political issue, because otherwise they're going to ignore it entirely. It's my belief, although, I'll just clarify that obviously this is speculation, but it's my belief that if you look at the Obama administration, it's probably instructive as to what will unfold with the Assange case. So we know that there were at least a handful of leaked cases that were germinating and in the works when President George W. Bush was in office. Then Obama took office, Eric Holder was Attorney General, and they had these leaked prosecutions they inherited. And one of the things they said, at least I think it was Holder who said this to defend the aggressive nature of the Justice Department, was to say, well, they, you know, these were left over from the Bush administration, and they had to finish and complete these cases. And so they carried them onward. And I expect that to be the same excuse given by Joe Biden. You know, they don't have to take responsibility for indicting Julian Assange now. Trump already did that work. It was Jeff Sessions when he was Attorney General who essentially made certain that this happened. And then it's Bill Barr who has discouraged Donald Trump from issuing any kind of pardon for Julian Assange, or discouraged Trump from pressuring him to back off the case. And so I think that they have a kind of luxury. They can hide behind the fact that the Trump Justice Department brought the case. They can allow it to keep going onward. If it goes forward with appeals, they can let it go through the entire judicial system of the UK right until the Foreign Office has to put the final stamp of approval on it right before he gets put on a plane. You know, Joe Biden then might have a decision on his hands, whether to decide to instruct the Justice Department, or the Justice Department might have a decision as the Attorney General could decide to back off the prosecution. But I do see, again, this scenario where Assange is kept in limbo because both political parties, not just Republicans, but Democrats, and I'd say even Democrats more aggressively than Republicans, loathe and despise Julian Assange and do not care about the fact that this unprecedented prosecution is hugely damaging to press freedom in the United States, undermines the First Amendment, but it also trashes press freedom throughout the world.
Kevin, speaking of the two political parties, there were people on the left who did not support voting for Joe Biden. They argued that he wouldn't be the lesser of two evils, but rather the more effective of two evils. Is this view reflected in the appointments that Biden has made to date and is considering making?
Yeah, so first, I'll just say that I'm not one to say anything about how anybody votes. I do think that this just basically deludes you into believing that you have a choice between the people who are running for office. But that said, when you look at the people around Biden's circle that he is bringing on board to staff his administration, it does send a signal that what is going to be embraced are people who supported the Iraq War, people who have stood behind this war that is still going on in Afghanistan, who are visibly distraught at the possibility that Trump would remove troops from Afghanistan, even though what he's doing is clearly prepping the ground, or his Pentagon is prepping the ground for the kind of quote-unquote smart war that we've been sold, where the Obama administration, you know, depended on special operations forces and drone strikes in order to pursue its military policy in Middle Eastern and North African countries, for example. And Somalia, I would add to that in the mix. And you look at these appointments and you see that they've supported regime change war in Syria. These are people who backed Libya, that the destruction of a country that is now a failed state. You see that and you have to conclude that these people are going to reconstitute and revamp the country in a way that returns it to one that has been waging endless wars around the world. And these are people who are clearly not satisfied with the way that Donald Trump has managed the country, and they think they can do it better, but that doesn't make it any less brutal in its result. And I also am concerned about the tensions that might be ramped up between Russia, with people being brought on board who believe that there should be more troops deployed to countries around around Russia, and you know the extent to which they might be willing to ramp up tensions with China. I'm particularly concerned when it comes to Russia, since it's a nuclear power, what that might mean for intensifying nuclear threats between the United States and Russia. And so I do think that, you know, we should be terribly concerned by the people who are being appointed. We have individuals who are tied to torture. Avril Haines, who is taking over has been the pick for the Director for National Intelligence, who would be Biden's James Clapper, is a woman who backed Gina Haspel for CIA director position. And Gina Haspel was involved in the destruction of torture tapes. We know documented waterboarding. And so I do think it's hugely concerning, at least in terms of the national security and foreign policy. I can't really, I'll leave more domestic issues as a separate thing, but you know, I focus closely on the national security and foreign policy elements, and they are terribly concerning.
You maintain that progressives should not have any illusions about the direction, about the policies, both foreign and domestic, that the Democratic Party is going to take. So what do you advise? Do progressives have any realistic expectations of changing the Democratic Party from the inside? That is to say, changing its support to militarism and its foreign policy and achieving a more social democratic distribution of wealth in the domestic policy? I mean, what do you advise? This is really a dilemma.
I have no illusions about this Democratic Party establishment. When we see what they've done in two straight election cycles to suppress Bernie Sanders as a candidate who could represent their party, even as you saw a groundswell of support and enthusiasm that could have that we know has benefited the party up and down the ballot, because they stand for things that involve social, racial, environmental, and economic justice, even in just, you know, ways that are within the tradition of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I mean, they don't take us to a kind of socialism that we see in Bolivia or other countries in the global South. It's just trying to get back to a party that cares about the working class. We've seen some modest, but not a lot of attention to military operations abroad, to our involvement in Forever War. You did hear Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez speak out, and Ilhan Omar has spoken out against imperialism and connected imperialism to the need for justice in the United States. And so that held a lot of promise, but you look at the consultant class, you look at the elites that make up the power structure of the Democratic Party, and it is very clear that they are not an alternative to the Republican Party. They're not presenting a meaningful alternative to Trumpism, which is just essentially unbridled aggression, America first, you know, the belief that there needs to be no apologies as the United States uses force and tries to dominate any sector. I mean, we've seen examples of this through the brutal sanctions against Iran. We've seen the coup attempt that was promoted and pushed in Venezuela. And those are some of the examples that are there. And I don't think that, for one, we know the Democratic Party and Joe Biden's administration is going to remain supportive of Juan Guaido and the coup in Venezuela. And we know that if sanctions end, it's actually an if. Even if we return to an Iran nuclear deal, which they want to do, they may still keep some sanctions to force compliance, even though it was Donald Trump that pulled out of the deal, and Iran never did anything wrong. And now they're going through a hugely catastrophic COVID-19 outbreak because of this militaristic policy of enforcing sanctions against them. So I do not have any illusions about what can be done, but I will caveat it with a major if. If we defy this refrain that says you have to give Biden a chance, which is the same chorus we heard about giving Obama a chance when he stepped into office in 2008, if people decide that they are not going to just take orders from the Democratic Party and fall into line, that they are going to be a meaningful force that opposes politicians and demands action on these things that are festering issues, then perhaps we might have some hope. But I still question the kinds of energy and resources that are expended in reforming a party that has all of these elites that are so actively opposed to everything that we stand for.
Kevin, you've been covering the trials of whistleblowers over the last several years. We first met, in fact, when we interviewed you about the trial of Chelsea Manning. She was tried under the 1917 Espionage Act. That act was first used 100 years ago against anti-war socialists who opposed American entry into the First World War, notably Eugene V. Debs. The Obama administration resurrected it and successfully used it against whistleblowers. Why do you think the Espionage Act was revived and is getting a second go-around? And is it a threat to journalism and the First Amendment guarantee of the right for us to freely write and to learn?
It absolutely is a threat to the freedom of the press. It's also a threat to the First Amendment. It's always been a law that targeted speech. As far as its history goes, we had a very exceptional witness who addressed the history of the Espionage Act during the extradition trial, His name is Kerry Shankman, and he did some incredible work parrying and challenging the prosecutor, Claire Dobbin, who was trying to twist his words and get him off of his message, which was to speak to what the Espionage Act has allowed the government to do. And, you know, thus far, there's never been a case that prosecuted a publisher in this manner, but there have been cases in which people were threatened. There have been threatened cases against journalists like Seymour Hersh and James Bamford. Beacon Press was threatened as they planned to publish the Pentagon Papers. And so it's always been a thing, and especially it's been a way of going after people who are anti-war or against the expansion of U.S. empire or against the aggressive foreign policy of the United States. There were nearly 2,500 individuals who were prosecuted under the act for dissenting views and opposing the U.S.'s entry into World War I back during that era. When this came into to being, and you know, it comes off as a kind of antiquated law, but what we've seen from our political class is that they really want to just find ways to perfect it and update it. I mean, it is over 100 years old, and I think we are going to see some reform in the future, but I'm concerned that what we're going to see from our politicians is an effort to make it a tool for the Justice Department that can effectively clamp down against leaks, because it's been revived since we do not have an Official Secrets Act. There is an Official Secrets Act in the UK, but we do not have a law against, just blanket law against federal government employees revealing information that is even classified. What we do have is this law, the Espionage Act, that says that if you reveal national defense information that would do grave damage to the national security of this country or would advantage a foreign power, et cetera, that then you could be guilty of a crime if you knew that what you were doing would do damage to the U.S. And they prosecuted it as a strict liability law, saying just because it was classified, you should have known that it would do damage. And they've used this very conveniently. But right now, we know that everyone in government really doesn't like that technology has proliferated in a way that enables us to leak. There's insider threat programs. There's all kinds of stuff that is part of another show. But this Espionage Act has been used in a way that, you know, it's kind of lawfare in a sense. It's been used in a way to make an example out of anyone who would dare to reveal and expose crimes. And if you blow the whistle and you're on the other side of the political establishment, in the last 15 years, we've seen how quickly your lives can be destroyed.
Unfortunately, we're running out of our allotted time. I do want to ask you one last question, though, and that is about the potential prosecution of Trump. Biden has said he doesn't want to do it. I remember Obama saying that after he took office, that we have to look forward, not backward, and he refused to prosecute people in the Bush administration for their initiation of the illegal war against Iraq and for their torture. What does this say about the rule of law, that the position that Obama took and then the one that Biden seems to be taking? What does that say about the rule of law?
To me, it's representative of a two-tiered justice system that really is breaks down around class. You know, if you're poor, lower class, you have no way to get out from under these prosecutions. There's no, you know, truth and reconciliation. There's no moving forward, not looking back for people who, you know, don't have rent, don't have money to pay their bills. They've been found guilty of nonviolent drug offenses. There's no looking forward, not backward with them. You see this two-tiered system when it comes to leaks. Lower-level people like Reality Winner, Terry Albury, Daniel Hale, these are Trump-era Espionage Act prosecutions. They get tried aggressively and prosecuted and sent to trial, and they'll go to prison. If you're an elite and you leak information, there's no crime. There's no prosecution against you. And you can continue to advise government, and you can continue to market yourself and be part of the consultant class. You continue to have prestige. And, you know, it's just a double standard. It's very clear that Bush administration officials got off because they were high ranking. Lower level people, I mean, I think there were even soldiers, lower level soldiers, who have been punished for being involved in war crimes. And, you know, in a sense, when the people above them have been held accountable, not at all, you know, they sort of have a reason to be upset that they're the ones that are being scapegoated and being treated as if they're the bigger war criminals, when in fact, you know, we know it's Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld and others that perpetrated the Iraq War, and we know it's the people who have developed this drone program that says the world is a battlefield and we can launch bombs and extrajudicially assassinate anyone around the world, that those people have blood on their hands and there should be some kind of a reckoning. And yet we know that'll never happen. And with the torture program, we know that there are people who should never be near the U.S. government again making policy, and yet there is no justice for the torture they carried out.
Kevin, we want to remind our listeners that you're the managing editor of Shadowproof, and you have the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. How can our listeners follow you?
Yeah, so go to shadowproof.com. That's shadowproof.com. You can find my work there. I've also been doing a weekly newsletter called The Dissenter. It's dissenter.substack.com. And it covers whistleblower stories, and it has updates on WikiLeaks. So I'd really encourage, especially given the content of our conversation, and it's been great talking with you, that if anyone wants additional reporting and further updates on Julian Assange and other related cases, that they go there and subscribe. Thank you.
It's really been enlightening speaking with you. We very much admire the work you're doing, and we want to thank you for being on Law & Disorder. You take it easy. We'll get you back on the show as soon as we can. You be well.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
As coronavirus positivity rates have been soaring nationwide, two states, New York and California, have shown vastly different responses. In New York State, nearly 5% of the prisoners have tested positive for COVID-19. Public health experts have warned that to reduce the spread of the virus, prison populations should be cut to 50% capacity. While Governor Andrew Cuomo has ordered the release of 3,100 New Yorkers, he has not used his power of clemency, either through a pardon or commutation. In stark contrast, Governor Gavin Newsom of California has expedited the release of nearly 9,000 prisoners and has issued 55 commutations and 4 medical reprieves between March and November. Back on the East Coast, Andrew Cuomo has granted just 2 commutations in January and another 3 in June. Critics call that number outrageous. Steve Zeidman, who co-directs CUNY Law School's Defenders Clinic Second Look Project, told Gothamist that clemency is, quote, an urgent necessity that is being ignored. The clinic currently represents 50 persons whose clemency petitions await the governor's decision. The governor's office has declined to comment on whether Cuomo will issue more commutations this year. For the past 6 holiday seasons, advocates have gathered to plead with Cuomo to commute more sentences. But for the most part, he has ignored those pleas. Joining us today is Jose Saldana, executive director of the nonprofit organization RAP, Release Aging Persons in Prison. Jose, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Jose, paint us a picture, if you will, of the conditions that inmates in New York State are facing, especially now during the COVID pandemic.
Well, let me just first start off with just a little background. You know, having languished in prisons for nearly four decades, I know firsthand that the elderly people in New York State prisons have faced a health crisis long before COVID-19 hit. A health crisis that's predicated by inadequate medical health care, negligence or indifference, and this has caused premature deaths in New York State prisons. I've lost several, and I'm talking about several friends and mentors. Off the top of my head, Sheikh Noor, Abdul Majid, Bashir, Oman Shasha, these men died at a relatively young age in their late 50s or early 60s. This was the condition that they faced for years and decades. Now comes COVID-19, which is poses a super health crisis. Today, we're getting letters, emails, phone calls from incarcerated people, in particular the elderly, who are terrified that if they get infected, they may not survive. In the initial phases, men were going to sick call. And if they make it to sick call, you know, sometimes it's so overcrowded that they actually were suspending sick call. But if they make it to see a nurse, they would only get a couple of Tylenols and told to go back to yourself. If it gets worse, then put down for sick call again. And in the beginning, sick call was just a difficult thing to accomplish because it was so many people reporting that they was having sick symptoms. But those who are tested and are tested to be positive, they, for the most part, do not get medical care. What they do get instead is punitive care. They are placed in isolation, stripped of all their property for 14 days to tough it out. For the most part, it's not until a person has severe symptoms, and in these cases, it's been proven to be fatal. But those who have severe symptoms, then they are given medical attention. In a few cases that I personally know, like Benjamin Smalls, they started his care too late, put him on a ventilator too late, and he passed away. And this is the general fear that the elderly have in New York State prisons. There is no mass testing. If you're positive, they will go around and do a limited amount of contact tracing.
Jose Saldana, why is Governor Cuomo not dealing with the crisis in the prisons?
Well, I think we all pretty much know that Governor Cuomo does not care too much for the humanity, those who are incarcerated. He doesn't really care too much about the community where we come from. You know, it's been established this COVID had exposed the disparity of health care, and he acknowledges that, but does absolutely nothing about it in our communities. He's not going to do much about it in New York State prison.
And in contrast, Jose, we know that in California, the governor there has released, I think, nearly 9,000 prisoners, Governor Gavin Newsom, and he's issued 55 commutations and a few medical reprieves. Give us a sense of the scale of our population of elder prisoners in New York facilities. How many thousands are we talking about?
We're talking about at least 9,000 elderly men who are 50 years and over. And for the most part, you know, I'm an elderly person. I know that as I age, I incur just health problems that come that are age-related, that just come from growing old. And in the New York State prisons, we grow older a lot quicker. And to Governor Cuomo does not recognize any of these scientific facts. As you know, he is way behind in the numbers of other governors, even Republican governors, in granting clemency to those who may very well die in prison if they are infected by this virus.
9,000 elderly prisoners in New York State. How many prisoners altogether?
We're talking about right under 37,000 altogether. The number has been reduced substantially in the last few years. But in contrast, the number of elderly remains the same, if not increases. Because as long as you're not releasing men who have been convicted of violent crimes, men and women who have served decades already, people are just going to get old, sick, and die in prison.
We've heard that our friend Russell Maroon Schoetz has tested positive, on his way actually to have an outside surgery for his stage 4 cancer. How are the families of these men and women responding when they get notice that their relative has contracted the virus? Is there an outpouring of support and advocacy?
Yes, in New York, and I'm sorry to hear that about Maroon, because, you know, he should have been released years, if not decades ago. It's the same with one of our dear friends in New York, David Gilbert, 76 years old, should have been released. But, you know, he's also fearful of contracting the disease because it may prove fatal. But the community of families with incarcerated loved ones, we are finally organizing them, bringing them all together and denounce this practice of mass incarceration, denounce Governor Cuomo's lack of concern for their loved ones who are now suffering a greater health crisis than they were before the COVID-19 hit New York State prison.
I've been in contact for many years with David Gilbert, who I consider a dear friend. He's actually in prison not far from where I live, the Catskill Mountains. And I just read yesterday that of the 300 people tested at the Shawangunk Correctional Facility, 100 had tested positive. And you really can't contain that in a prison, can you, because of the conditions of the prison. If you've got 100 people who've tested positive in the prison, it's going to spread. There's really no way to stop that, is there?
It is impossible. I spent many years at Shawangunk Correctional Facility. That is a sardine can. There is no, you can't social distance past a feet, 12 inches, never mind six. We get letters and emails from men at Shawangunk Correctional Facility, and they are living in terror because they know it's mathematically impossible to social distance. And on top of that, they're not giving them adequate PPE. They expect a mask to last a month.
What is your organization, RAP, Release Aging Persons in Prison, calling on Governor Cuomo and other legislators to do about this crisis?
Well, we are calling on Governor Cuomo to issue clemency toward decarceration. You know, all the experts have already established that in prison, the only real safe, humane measure to take is to decarcerate. Governor Cuomo has to use his executive authority, because no one can question his authority when it comes to clemency. Just issue clemency to decarcerate and begin with those who are most vulnerable to the disease, those who are already suffering major illnesses, to decarcerate by releasing these men and women. It has been proven that these men and women are no risk to public safety whatsoever. In fact, we enhance community safety once we are released from prison.
We've been speaking with Jose Saldana, who's the executive director of Release Aging Persons in Prison.
I'm curious what the response from the officers, the Correctional Officers Union, has been to this crisis. Are they calling for any new measures?
Well, the only measures that they're calling for is self-interest measures. You know, when this thing hit, well, even before it hit the New York State prisons, Governor Cuomo, what he did, he suspended all visits. So that means that he took a most punitive measure to this, and as he does in every other crisis during his tenure as governor. He suspended all visitations, thinking or assuming that the only way the virus could be introduced to his prison is through the family members. He was wrong. It was introduced to his staff, correction officers, who for the most part did not give a damn. Even if they were sick, we get reports that some of them were visibly sick and would not wear a mask. And even in some instances, they actually said that they did not care whether they gave it to the incarcerated man whose custody they was under.
What possible reason can be given to keep these elderly people in prison? They're no threat to society. I'd like to ask you about that. it just seems to me to be cruel and vindictive to keep them there. What kind of pressure is Cuomo on from, say, the prosecutors and the cops to keep these people in prison?
Well, as you know, Governor Cuomo is a former prosecutor. He was very complicit in establishing the policies of mass incarceration. And for the most part, we have to understand that the prisons, as well as the entire criminal legal system, is dominated by the culture of racism. The legacy of racism dictates policy and practices in reference to New York State prisons, as well as prisons all over the country. And Governor Cuomo is just acting out who he is and what he is. He does not value the men and women in prison. For the most part, he doesn't really give a damn about Black humanity or dignity, unless he thinks that by releasing men and women, he will be presidential. And of course, those are his aspirations. But at the detriment to the men and women who we care and love, he is doing absolutely nothing.
Jose, what can our listeners do to get involved, to help apply the pressure on how do we find RAP online?
Go to the RAP website. This is rappcampaign.com. Get involved with this campaign. We are the only campaign in New York City that's addressing this in an organized fashion. We address the issues of elder people languishing in prison needlessly, and we are also now involved in campaigning for clemency to issue to the loved ones and the families who are out here grieving with really no one to go to but RAP. We are trying to organize critical mass support so that Governor Cuomo has to respond to these demands to grant clemency.
Will you give that website one more time, please, Jose?
That's RAP, rappcampaign.com.
Jose, we want to thank you for the persistent and effective work that you and everyone at RAP has been doing over the years. Thank you for being a part of the eyes and ears to let our listeners know a bit about what's happening behind bars, especially in New York State. And we wish you the best. Stay safe, and we look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Thank you, and y'all stay safe also.
You take it easy, Jose. So long.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Michael, before he passed away in 2016, our former co-host Michael Ratner was actually writing his autobiography. And I hear we have an exciting development on that front.
Yeah, we sure do. It's finally going to appear. Michael courageously almost finished the book. His friend, the writer Zach Sklar, stepped in and using notes that Michael had taken and interviews that had been done with Michael and interviews with family and friends, Zach finished the book, and Orr Books is about to publish it. It has a publication of March, but it should be available next month. People can get it if they link to lawanddisorder.org. We'll send the link to the book, and then they can get it. And I think it's on sale right now as a pre-publication. It's called Moving the Bar by Michael Ratner. Chris Hedges said, there are two types of people in this world, those who care and those who don't. If you care as deeply and passionately as Michael Ratner, the suffering of the oppressed forces, you too become a radical. And the subtitle of Michael's book is Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer. I wrote the introduction, Heidi, and I can tell you it's a really good book. It's dramatic and interesting, instructive, inspirational. Lots of good legal stories. Michael explains the stuff that he got involved in from the beginning. You know, he started out when he first started working at the Center for Constitutional Rights 45 years ago. He started out going up to Attica to investigate the prison rebellion up there. And he finished his last case, his last client before he died was Julian Assange. And the book starts off with Michael meeting Julian Assange, accompanied by the great lawyer Len Wineglass, in London to try to figure out what to do to defend him. That's the start of the book. And it's a dramatic retelling
of the Assange story and the other important human rights cases that Michael got involved in over his 40-year career.
Michael, I just love the title, Moving the Bar, because it speaks really to what Michael Ratner stood for, raising the level to which we should all subscribe in adhering to human rights, but also injecting it with humanity in terms of making the moving stories of the people and the movements that were involved in cases that he represented.
Yeah, I'll just give you a quote from Balthazar Garzon about the book. Garzon is the Spanish judge, the very creative and courageous Spanish judge who was the one who was responsible for indicting Pinochet and other important humanitarian works. And Garzon says, Michael Ratner was an example for those of us who believe that the fight for human rights is an inalienable responsibility. Balthazar Garzon.
The book is Moving the Bar, and you can order it now from OR Books.
You can get a pre-order copy. It's on sale. And if you'll go to our website, lawanddisorder.org, we'll direct you on how to do it.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.